What's going on, everyone? It's time for the With a Bullet podcast. My name is Todd Golden. His name is Matt Golden. What's going on, Matt?
Not a whole lot. It's warming up finally. It's kind of like a fake warm up. It's probably going to be like zero next week, but it's warm now. So
I have my windows open today.
Oh, well, it wasn't that warm here, but it was above freezing anyway. So.
What was your high today?
I think it was somewhere in the 30s.
Yeah, we were close to 60, so we went.
Oh, okay.
it's fake spring, though, because there will be another cold snap.
Exactly, yeah.
Full-on spring. It's just a trick the devil played on us to make us think he doesn't exist. Or maybe he does exist. I don't even know what I mean by that.
Okay.
So anyway, this chart was my pick, and we're doing the country chart from March 1st, 1969. What'd you think of this one?
I thought this was pretty interesting, actually. I liked most of the songs that I had to cover this week. So,
well, it's
I'm not sure what your experience was with it, but
I also enjoyed it quite a bit, and it made me wonder why. Well, it didn't make me wonder why. I mean, I guess that's not the right way to put it, but this was a really interesting period for country music, because while there's some traditionalism, I mean, it depends on your point of view, what you think is traditional country, but there's some traditionalism going on here, but you can also see the the mores of society getting into the music a little bit. And it kind of makes me wonder why there was ever like a backlash against this period, because it's pretty good artistically. And of course, compared to today's country, which is really, really manufactured, which, you know, a lot of this stuff was considered manufactured in its own time, but it feels so much more genuine and, you know, and good. So yeah, I enjoyed it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty diverse too. I mean, at least from my songs anyway, just kind of like all over the map in terms of style and everything.
Right. And, you know, it also, you know, took in a lot of different, it wasn't just all drinking songs and, you know, heartbreak songs either. I mean, there's some, at least on my side, there was a little bit of social commentary and stuff like that. So so it was interesting. But why don't we go ahead and dive in?
Okay.
It you started with number 40, which is Please Take Me Back by Jim Glazer.
Jim Glazer was the younger brother of outlaw country singer Tom Paul Glazer. And with their other brother, Chuck, they had occasionally sing together as the Glazer Brothers. We actually had one of their songs on the last country chart we did, which was actually the only other country show that we've done. But he was also a songwriter. He wrote Woman, Woman for Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, which was a hit right around this time. I think that may have been on a recent chart that we did. But
yeah, than the one we did 2 weeks ago, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Anyway. But this song was a pretty minor hit for Jim. This was actually its peak on the chart. And it's kind of a typical country ballad from this era. Lots of steel guitar, kind of over-the-top eyeing vocals, or background vocals anyway. And what sets it apart is Jim's voice. He had a pretty smooth tenor voice, which was kind of uncommon for country. This is going to sound odd, but the closest comparison that I can think of to his voice is Eric Carmen. So it was like Eric Carmen doing a country ballad.
Yeah.
But this one was pretty good. I mean, it probably should have gone a little bit higher than 40, but this is where it peaked on here. So.
Well, the Raspberries did do some country songs, but the one I can think of wasn't sung by Eric Carmen. So there's that.
Oh, which song was that?
It's on side three. I can't remember what its title is. It's at the end of side A, I want to say. I actually just bought that album.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that one. I actually have country that album, ish. Too.
It's country-ish. I can't remember. But Eric Carmen doesn't sing it, so it doesn't matter.
Okay. I'll have to look at that when we're done here.
But, yeah, you should.
But anyway, 39 for you is Loretta Lynn with Woman of the World, Leave My World Alone.
Well, this is another in the long country tradition of hating folks from the city. City slicker woman comes in, steals man away from Loretta, and Loretta doesn't like it one little bit. Basically, in the song, this is before. See, in the 70s, they probably would have just straight up said, go to hell. But Lynn very carefully tells the woman from the city to go to hell without actually saying it. So a little bit more artful. That maybe didn't go over well in country in the late 1960s. But it wouldn't be too much longer until it would. This was Loretta's third number one hit. And this is good shit, as it usually is from Loretta Lynn. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't really go wrong with her.
No, you cannot. And here's a title next up at number 38 that confuses me. Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day by Hank Locklin.
Yeah, and this was Hank Locklin's very last top 40 country hit, and it came nearly 20 years after his first. His song The Same Sweet Girl hit the charts in spring of 49. His stuff was kind of typical 50s Nashville studio sound. But he didn't actually live in Nashville. He kind of commuted there. He lived in the Florida Panhandle. but his best-known song was Please Help Me, I'm Falling, which was an enormous hit about 10 years before this. And it's supposedly the second biggest country single ever, according to Billboard. But this one is a cover. It was originally recorded in 1931 by Benny Kruger and his orchestra. But it's primarily associated with Bing Crosby because he used it as the theme song to his radio show in the 30s. And because of that, it's kind of a standard. Will Rogers, Eddie Fisher, Connie Francis, Rosemary Clooney all covered it at one point. Lachlan's version definitely has like the 50s country easy listening feel to it. It wouldn't have sounded out of place on the 1958 episode that we did a couple months ago. But it's not bad. It does sound like a relic compared to some of the other songs in here, though. So,
I think it's cool that Freddy Krueger had a band in the 1930s.
Yeah, it was the orchestra of 100 maniacs.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Or did they also? Well, they wouldn't have had TVs back then. So how did he? You know, did he pick up any mental patients and throw them into a TV or a radio set maybe back then?
Probably a radio set. I mean, you know, that'd be appropriate for the era. And I mean, they had like the huge radios with the tubes. So, I mean, it was big enough to do it.
Oh, yeah. No question.
One of those.
That would be lethal. And yeah. Instead of like needles coming out of his arms, and he would just say, something like, you want some reefer or you want to be a hophead? I'm trying to figure out the lingo.
Yeah.
As Freddy Krueger would say it. So, yeah.
Or it'd be like bad bathtub gin or something.
Yeah, well, maybe that's what he would emerge out of and then, like, drown you in it. Like, you wanted alcohol to be legal. Now it's legal forever.
Yeah, exactly.
Enjoy it in hell.
Right. Yeah. But number 37 for you is Jeannie C. Riley with The Price I Pay to Stay.
Riley is from Nashville by way of Texas, and she's definitely best known for Harper Valley PTA, which these days is sort of thought of as a one-hit wonder. But I think she deserves quite a bit more recognition than that. First of all, her voice is pure country, almost through the looking glass, if I could talk, of country and into some other dimension, meaning her voice is so country, it almost seems like an exaggeration. It's like something somebody would come up with to like parody country.
Yeah.
Because it is heavy duty accent. She reminds me quite a bit, if you know your rockabilly, and God knows I know my rockabilly, of Janis Martin, who is a female rockabilly pioneer, but a very similar, a very Southern style of voice. Because of Harper Valley, which had come out within a year of this, Jenny C. Reilly sort of became a sex symbol in country circles. At least she was marketed that way, much as Bobby Gentry was a little bit closer to the rock scene, but they kind of traded in the same kind of TV media in particular. So a lot of common ground between those two. Reilly really disliked that image that was being fostered for her. She could carry it off. She was very attractive back then. But she eventually turned to Christian music in the mid 70s, partly as a result of that image that she was distancing herself from, that she was never really comfortable with. She's a lot like Loretta Lynn in the bluntness of the song she chose. And this song is a great example. The first line from this song, quote, "There was a time when I thought it did some good to get down on my knees to you, and I would. But baby, now that's all changed. Today's a brand new day, and you ain't worth the price I pay to stay." You can assume that's a blowjob reference or not, but even if it isn't, I'm not kidding. I mean, it comes out that way when you hear it. But even if it's not, it's a great statement of intent right off the bat at the beginning of the song that Jenny C. isn't having it with her beau anymore. Reilly is almost always backed by pretty choice Nashville musicians in this period. In other words, she's really good. And Matt has her again later with maybe her best song of all. So this is like the teaser. Get the Chaser, which is better. So yeah, the song that's coming up later is really, really good. So, but she's, you know, it's a shame that she's not thought of in better, you know, it doesn't have a higher reputation than she does, because every song I've ever heard by her is really interesting and very, you know, if you've heard Harper Valley PTA, which is a story song, but it's kind of like a, almost like a fighting country, you know, like underdog, you know, middle, lower to middle class type point of view. That's what a lot of these songs are too. So it works.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Anyway, next up for you, number 36 is Just Hold My Hand by Johnny A.
This is a skip. I couldn't really find anything at all about Johnny A.
So. Johnny A is, the A is for country.
Okay.
I don't know what the A is for. It's for Johnny, maybe it's Johnny Fever.
Could be.
That wouldn't be Johnny A. I'm trying to think of somebody named John with a last name of A, and I'm coming up blank.
Yeah, I can't think of any either.
The only one I can think of is John Allen, the once co-owner of the White Sox.
Okay. I don't think it's him. Yeah.
I don't think it's him. And
probably not.
Trying to move the White Sox to Milwaukee at this point, so good for him. But
right, yeah, exactly.
Strange reference.
Yeah. See, but number 35 for you is Billy Walker with From the Bottle to the Bottom.
Well, with a great title like this, you'd think I would be all over it, but I'm skipping it. It's a good song, but had to find some skips.
Okay.
Next up for you, number 34 is Yours Love by Waylon Jennings.
This is pre-Outlaw Waylon, obviously, and on the cover of the album that the single came from, a pompadoured, clean-shaven Waylon is, like, in the forest, wistfully gazing up at a beam of sunlight. It could very easily be, like, a Porter Wagoner album cover from the same era. I mean, it doesn't even look like Waylon Jennings. And the same kind of goes for the song. It doesn't, like, sound what you would think of when you think of Waylon Jennings. It was written by Harlan Howard, who wrote I Fall to Pieces for Patsy Cline, and it's just kind of a standard Nashville ballad. It's kind of weird hearing Waylon sing something like this, because I mean, I'm more familiar with like the later Outlaw stuff, and it's not really a good fit. It's actually kind of off-putting, really.
One thing to remember about Waylon's Outlaw period, though, is he did mix in a shit ton of ballads in with the, you know, the Outlaw shit kicker type songs.
Yeah, that is true, but they weren't really like as syrupy as this one.
Yeah.
Which is the off-putting part for me, but luckily that would change in like a few years after this. So
well, even in this period, I mean, the thing that I think what I've always zeroed in on country, or the country that I like, is always guitar based. And even in this pre-Outlaw period, Waylon was still putting out some guitar jams, the big hit he had in this period was
the only daddy to walk the line.
Yeah, if I could get my memory.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, which is from this era. So, you know, at least he had the roots of what it takes to make, at least in my tastes, good country. So
that is true, I guess. Yeah.
Almost all good country has its roots in guitar. I think I address this later with another song. I won't ruin it. So I have a point to make in all this.
Okay. But 33 for you is Leanne Ashley with While Your Lover Sleeps.
This was a weird one. It sounded a little bit like early Allman Brothers, kind of almost pastoral, crossed with early 60s country. So think like Please Help Me, I'm Falling or something like that. So it was like a weird mix of styles between those two. And this song is also an example of how the sexual revolution was penetrating the world of country. This song is told from a second person perspective, which is weird. You don't hear that in songs very often, but addressing a woman to go through her emotions on having an affair. It was almost like the narrator wasn't necessarily her husband. It was almost like telling a story, like from a detached point of view, like, here's all this stuff you did to, you know, as you wrapped up. It was actually towards the end of the one night stand or affair or whatever you want to call it. So interesting perspective on the song. And it was the last of Leon Ashley's, second last, I should say, of his six top 40 country songs. Ashley was a pioneer in that he started his own record company, and his 1967 song, Laura, What's He Got That I Ain't Got, in parentheses, was the only number one country song to that point where the artist wrote, recorded, released, distributed, and published a number one. And it would be Ashley's only number one in his career. So, but I like this song. It just had a cool, different point of view that you don't hear very often.
Yeah, I didn't mind this one either. So
kind of detached, but also kind of trying to, almost like trying to read somebody's emotions instead of telling it like you're going through the emotions. It was interesting.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, next up for you, number 32 is Please Let Me Prove My Love for You by Dave Dudley.
Central Wisconsin's greatest country artist. He was from Spencer, Wisconsin, which is a little town near Wausau. And he specialized in trucker country. His best known song was 6 Days on the Road, which has been covered quite a few times and details aspects of long-haul trucking life, like fudging logbooks, dodging scales, and taking little white pills to stay awake. But then there's other lesser-known songs like Truck Driving Son of a Gun, Me and Old CB, Trucker's Prayer, Truck Driving Man, Don't Mess with U.S. Truckers, Where's That Truck, Keep on Truckin', which actually wasn't a cover, You Ain't Gonna Truck with Us, I'm Proud to Say I Drive a Truck. Anyway, you get the point. He was so associated with trucking that the Teamsters made him an honorary member. He didn't actually drive a truck himself. It was kind of like a Beach Boys and surfing situation. But this one's a little change of pace because it's not actually about trucking. It's just a standard 60s Nashville studio sound ballad. You could probably interpret this one as a trucking song, I guess. Maybe he's trying to prove his love to some girl at a truck stop or something. But kind of prefer the trucking stuff from Dave. So
did he write Truck Driving Neighbors Downstairs by Beck?
No, he didn't. No. He may have inspired the CB Funker song from the German episode that we did, because apparently he was like pretty popular in Germany, or at least in German country music circles.
Yeah, which is a big circle.
Exactly.
he didn't write that song, but I lived it for a year. My God.
Truck Driving Neighbors Downstairs.
I had, they weren't literally truck drivers, but I lived, if you know that song, the characters in it, I lived above. I must have lived in the same apartment Beck did. So, ridiculous.
Yep. Yeah. It would have been funny if Beck did live in Muncie.
Yeah, I think he did. Because that song to me is autobiographical. Absolutely. Without a doubt. I don't want to get into it, but let's just say it was a year of... I also compare it to living above the cast of the Hurt So Good video by John Cougar.
Okay.
It was one or the other. Take your pick. It was just ridiculous.
Right, yeah. See, but 31 for you is Jaylee Webb with She's Looking Better by the Minute.
This is also goes into the grand country tradition, this time of drinking to make a woman look good at the bar. Inspirational line coming, quote, she don't look so awful bad considering all this beer I had, unquote. Webb, who recorded for Sun Records in the 50s, made a cottage industry out of drinking songs, much like your previous artist did out of trucking songs. He made a comeback in 1967 with I Come A-Drinkin' to a Worn Out Wife Like You, a response song to Loretta Lynn's Don't Come Home A-Drinkin'. Other songs include Bottle Turner Off, Bottle Here I Come, among others. Who said the drinking song was a country cliche? Not Jaylee Webb. It was all over it. So, but obviously in the humor wing of country music, and it was pretty good.
I actually, did you find this one on YouTube?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't find this one. So, yeah.
I usually do my research in YouTube in case that way I'm killing two birds with one stone. If there's a good video to go with it, I'm not like, you know.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah.
So that's kind of my MO when I do my research. But next up for you, Matt, number 30, Flattery Will Get You Everywhere by Lynn Anderson.
Out of all the songs on my list, this is the one that sounded the most stereotypically country. Steel guitar is way out in front in this one, and Lynn kind of turns the twang in her voice up to 11. Just kind of stereotypical country stuff. But this one was actually written by Lynn's mom, Liz. Liz was a country star in her own right and was a pretty successful songwriter. She wrote Conway Twitty's first country hit, which was Guess My Eyes Were Bigger Than Her Heart, and a bunch of Merle Haggard's earlier songs, including I'm a Lonesome Fugitive, probably the best known out of those. She also like looked and sounded exactly like Lynn, and they were both recording at roughly the same time. So probably confusing for people, but as far as the lyrics go, I mean, pretty much everything you need to know is in the title. She basically just wants a guy to flatter her. That's it. I mean, pretty simple, but this one's pretty good, though. So
that's what I want every guy to do for me as well.
Yeah, exactly. But
I believe this leads us into your long distance dedication.
Yes, it does. Let me scroll down here. I'm staying on the country charts this week. We have 10 extra tracks on this one, so why not? At number 42, we have what's probably one of the most famous country songs ever. Definitely one of the most famous from this era. It's Tammy Wynette with Stand By Your Man. This was a pretty simple song, just one kind of down-tempo verse and then like a very rousing repeated chorus. It was written by Tammy and her producer Billy Sherrill in about 15 minutes. And it's basically about sticking with your guy through thick and thin, which was attacked by some people for being anti-feminist, which is something that Tammy never really understood. She just thought it was a simple love song. But it was a massive hit and crossed over onto the pop chart, which probably wouldn't have been possible without Tammy's performance. She does an amazing job with this, and pretty much just makes the song better by herself. I mean, if it had been in somebody else's hands, I mean, who knows if it would have like stuck in the public consciousness as long as it has. And speaking of that, this song has popped up in a ton of different places over the years. I mean, it was referenced by The Clash in Train in Vain. It was used in the memorable opening sequence of Five Easy Pieces, where Jack Nicholson's driving home from the oil fields to Karen Black, who actually played a character who is partially based on Tammy in Nashville. And it also popped up in the Blues Brothers and the Honky Tonk scene as one of two country songs that they knew, the other being the theme from Rawhide. And there was a classical Tammy skit from SNL where Jan Hooks sang the chorus of this song to tune of pieces by Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and Beethoven. And that skit is very cringeworthy now, by the way. I went back and checked it out. And Hillary Clinton infamously referenced it in a 60 Minutes interview during the 92 election, where she, like, I mean, this was after one of Bill's scandals with some woman, like, broke out, and she said that she wasn't going to stand by her man. She was there because she respected him. But that really pissed off Tammy, and Hillary later apologized for it. And it was also referenced by Tammy herself in her very weird collaboration with the KLF, Justified and Ancient, which was subtitled Stand by the Jams. But for the record, Tammy didn't really follow her own advice from this song. She was married about 5 times, but I guess she did stand by George Jones like the first 4 or 5 times he snuck off to the liquor store in his riding boar. But anyway, this is a great song, and I am going to dedicate this to The Clash. Let's see. Ordering chicken sandwich, ordering toast, but actually ordering a chicken salad sandwich and holding the chicken salad. And the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo Land. So, yeah.
The irony of this is, well, I'll talk about it later when I when this very subject pops up with one of my songs. Because Tammy didn't exactly stand by, not even during this period. Well, we'll get to it later. I don't want to spoiler alert my own song.
Okay,
let's just say
okay. Things
were pretty strife-ridden in Tammy's love life at this stage of the game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to bring up for this one. But, yep. But 29 for you is Carl Smith with Faded Love and Winter Roses.
This is a skip. It's a Hank Williams cover, of which there are quite a few on here. But it's, not worth it. So it's a skip.
Okay.
Next up for you, number 28, Each and Every Part of Me by Bobby Lewis.
This is a skip for me. I actually found out that there are several other Bobby Lewises who didn't record country. So that was kind of interesting. But this one's a skip. 27 for you is Nat Stuckey with Joe and Mabel's 12th Street Bar and Grill.
This is a great song. The song title refers to where Mommy and Daddy met, and also where Mommy just might be cuckolding Daddy these days.
Yeah.
It's an up-tempo song with some really good guitar in it and barrel house piano. Nat Stuckey sounds a little bit like Waylon Jennings if he was thrown into the fly machine with Jim Stafford. It has that Jim Stafford style of storytelling to it, kind of whimsical, sarcastic to some degree. And I'm impressed that he could get that line out, Joe and Mabel's 12th Street Bar and Grill, as basically a hook in the chorus, because that's pretty wordy for a chorus. But Nat Stuckey pulled it off. So really good song, though. I enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I like this one, too. And kind of like raucous bars will be a theme on here for at least a couple of the songs.
Yeah. It's in that vein. Good bar song. So number 26 for you, though, is Don't Wake Me, I'm Dreaming by Warner Mack.
This is a skip. It's just kind of a standard country ballad. Needed something to skip, too.
Is Warner Mack the Mack from the movie The Mack?
No, he isn't. Actually, Mack is short. His full last name was McIntosh, I think. Or actually, it was McPherson. So
from the Scottish wing of country.
Yes. Yeah. But 25 for you is Carl Perkins with Restless.
Well, this is rockabilly to its core. I mean, and the thing is, and I didn't really, you know, put two and two together on this until I watched a video of Carl Perkins singing this, but it's easy to forget for people our age who really only saw Perkins as an older man. He was only 36 at this point. I mean, we're not that far removed from the dawn of rockabilly, and he's still ready to rock out on this. And the clip I found is from the Kraft Music Hall show hosted by Johnny Cash. And Perkins just crushes a guitar solo in the middle of this. Really good. Not really country at all. It was really a rock guitar solo. But it's pretty awesome, whichever way you want to define it. Rock, country, country rock, croc, perhaps.
Croc, yeah.
This was at the time that Perkins was helping Bob Dylan out as he was coming up with the Nashville Skyline album. So this song would fit right into Nashville Skyline. Actually, would have rocked out probably a little bit more than some of that album. So, but good stuff from one of the pioneers of both rockabilly, country, rock, however you want to define it. Croc. He's the croc. Carl Perkins.
Yeah. Yep. And I actually have a song that was written by him coming up, too.
Oh, really?
So. Yes.
O-R-L-Y question mark. Anyway, next up for you, somebody I referenced earlier, number 24 is Let It Be Me by Glenn Campbell and Bobby Gentry.
I've sort of had this one before. We did a 69 albums chart about a year ago, and this album was on there. I skipped that that time around, but I'm doing it here now. This is a cover. The original version was in French, and it was called Je te parle ten, I think. Which literally translates to I belong to you, but for some reason it was changed to Let It Be Me when it finally made it over in English. The Everly Brothers did the best known version of the song. It came right in the middle of their peak period, and like most of their singles from that era, was a top 10 hit. And Jerry Butler and Betty Everett put out almost an identical version about a year later, which actually did better on the charts than the Everly's version. And what Glenn and Bobby are doing here is more or less the same thing as those two versions. For whatever reason, there were just like a ton of new versions of this song that came out in the late 60s. Nancy Sinatra, Petula Clark, Elvis, Fifth Dimension, Jimmy Webb, and so on. I'm not sure why that was, but I mean, Glenn and Bobby were just kind of riding that wave. Glenn's voice is a lot louder in the mix, so it doesn't even like sound like a duet either. Basically, it just sounds like Glenn Campbell singing the song. But since this was Glenn Campbell and he did have a TV show, there was a clip of this, and Glenn and Bobby are kind of singing this to each other in like a backyard set in front of a tire swing. And Bobby's wearing like a chartreuse colored jumpsuit, and her hair's in like kind of a beehive. So definitely like keeping up with the country styles of the time period. But I'm not sure why they picked the tree swing for this one, but they did. But a decent version of the song, though.
Just trying to make it look more innocent.
Probably.
Or maybe they just were into tire swings. Who knows?
Could be. But 23 for you is Marty Robbins with It's a Sin.
A lot of people didn't know that the Pet Shop Boys song was a cover. No, it's not that. I'm used to the El Paso style, West Texas, Western, I guess, kind of the Western and country and Western style that Marty Robbins is famous for, but this is more in line with like slow blues. So think Fats Domino style piano mixed with Ray Charles. There's some of that. There's a little bit of Ray Charles. Geez, I can't talk style organ with, and then also think of Elvis style male background singers. So think Comeback Elvis as sung by Robbins, only much bluesier. Think of Comeback Elvis at 1 a.m. in a bar type of type of vibe that Marty Robbins has going here. Really good song, kind of the revelation of the chart for me, because I've not really heard Marty Robbins sing in this style before. But really cool and bluesy and moody and good stuff from Marty Robbins.
Yeah, yeah, it was. This was a good one. So,
but next up for you, number 22, Ballad of $40 by Tom T. Hall.
This was a story song. Tom T. Hall did a lot of those. He actually wrote Harper Valley PTA about a year before this. But he's playing a gravedigger in this song, and he's kind of describing a funeral that's taking place. He kind of lets on that he knows the guy who's getting buried, but he's kind of vague about it. He mentions that he wants to pay his respects, but he doesn't own a suit, so he's kind of sitting in his truck waiting for it to end. And he probably also has a hangover, because he mentioned that he drank a case of beer while digging in the grave. But he starts describing some of the mourners. The guy's great uncle, who has like a limousine. His widow, who still looks good in black. The fire and brimstone preacher, and so on. It's told in kind of an amusing, humorous sort of way. But you're kind of wondering where he's going with it and where the $40 of the title come in. And then the last line comes, which is, "I hope he rests in peace, but the trouble is the guy owes me $40. Wham.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I like this one. And I found a clip of him performing this from Johnny Cash's show. And he suggests in the intro that this takes place in the same universe as Harper Valley PTA. So a lot of stuff going on at Harper Valley. So.
Well, there's really only one thing I think of when I think of Tom T. Hall, and that's, I love Leaves in the Wind, Pictures of My Friends, Birds of the World, and Squirrels.
Yes.
I love Coffee in a Cup, Little Fuzzy Pups, Bourbon in a Glass, and Grass.
Yes. Yeah.
I love you too.
Pick up trucks of little baby ducks.
Yeah, except for switch it. It's the other way around.
Oh, okay. he also sang I Like Beer.
Too, yes, he did.
Which was a different song.
Right. he had to get some more likes out. You know, he didn't get it all out in I Love. So.
Yeah, I mean, well, and beer's important enough where he had to make an entire song about
That's
it.
That's true. So. Very, very.
Yeah.
I love that song. I mean, pun unintended. I actually really enjoy that song when it comes on.
The I Love song?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's okay, I guess.
I like it. I feel it sincerely and ironically.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because I really do. I like most of the things in that song. I'm down with little baby ducks. It's fine.
Yeah, ducks are fine. But anyway, 21 for you is Roy Drusky with Where the Blue and Lonely Go.
Nah, this is a skip. He sounds like Burl Ives.
Okay.
But that brings us to our long distance dedication. And unlike you, I didn't stick with the country chart, because when we don't have 100, we can move around and make, you know, kind of feel our way around the cabin, so to speak. And so I went over to the album chart and I picked out number 123, which is the Hey Jude album by Wilson Pickett, which debuted this week. This was its debut spot. So I'm leaving the world of country, but not the South, because this album is pioneering for one really big reason. It was Duane Allman's big coming out party as a guitar player. Allman went to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where the Hey Jude album was recorded, with the famous session musicians at Muscle Shoals. And he went there to play session guitar, and it was totally unknown at this point. And it became very famous because it was just a great mix of his guitar and the Muscle Shoals horns and all that was already well known, primarily probably through Aretha Franklin at this point, but other bands as well. Very Staxy sounding. They weren't Stax, but very similar sound. And the album is Southern Soul at its finest, and Allman's guitar is prominent throughout it, giving it just another layer of kind of swing and ambiance that would have not been there had he not been playing. And of course, the masterpiece of this album is the title track, which is a cover of the Beatles' opus that itself had only been released 5 months earlier. So as we talked about before, covers came fast and furious in this period, tributes from other artists. I've said many times, I think Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude is the best cover I've ever heard. And it exceeds the Beatles version, in my opinion, which is extremely high, which is a really high bar to clear, because Hey Jude is one of the Beatles' best songs. So they really nailed it on this. And the best reason I can describe why I feel that way is to take everything great about the Beatles version of Hey Jude, you know, the slow build up to the crescendo in the middle, the long fade out, you know, that in the Beatles version, they add in the strings come in real dramatically during the na 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 part. This version is Southern Soul, but it captures the ambiance of all of that was good about the Beatles stuff, and then it adds other stuff. So add in Muscle Shoals horns instead of strings. Add in Allman's guitar, which Eric Clapton said the solo that Allman plays over the back half of Hey Jude is the best guitar he's ever heard in a song. And he immediately wanted to know, when he heard it originally, he immediately wanted to know who that was playing guitar on it, because he had never heard anything like it. You got Pickett's fantastic voice, which is perfect for Hey Jude. You have one thing that very rarely gets talked about is some unbelievable bass being played in this song. I don't know who played it. I looked up the album on Discogs, and it credits David Hood or Jerry Jemmett for bass on the album, but it didn't specifically say who played on this song. You have gritty Southern female background singers doing the na 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 at the part at the end. Plus Wilson Pickett does the bridge to the crescendo, which is, I mean, it's to die for. I mean, some have credited this track for launching Southern rock. I don't know about that. I think it's probably directly led to Derek and the Dominoes several years later, because this is really the genesis of where Clapton wanted to explore that type of music. But I do know that Pickett's Hey Jude is one of the greatest things I've ever heard. And this album, I listened to it, and it's really good throughout. I mean, he also covered Born to Be Wild on it, which was also a recent cover at this stage of the game. And it's also superior to the Steppenwolf version. So I dedicate this to Southern Soul and everything that's great about it, both the musical contributions and the vocal contributions. This one absolutely rules. So,
yeah, it's a great cover. And I haven't heard the version of Born to Be Wild, but I can't imagine that it'd be that hard to beat out Steppenwolf.
Well, I mean, that song has been heard so many times, it loses the impact it probably did when it was released, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're right about that.
It's almost become a cliche. So they did it, Pickett just did it in his own style, which was, and, you know, backed by the same musicians. So it's really good. Of course, Pickett almost did nothing but covers. So he was, you know, but he did some really good ones. I mean, his version of Sugar Sugar isn't bad either.
Right. Yeah.
It's different. It's more, if he had done that song 2 years later, it would have been reggae. I guarantee he would have, I don't know if his voice would have been right for that, but you can tell it's going in that direction. Maybe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or I just smoked a bunch of ganja and I'm high and I just made all that up.
Okay.
Anyway. Next up for you is number 20. What Are Those Things with Big Black Wings by Charlie Louvin or Louvin?
It's Louvin, but this one's a skip. It wasn't that bad, but I just needed something to skip here.
Maybe he has a Hawaii license, driver's license that says McLouvin.
I doubt that, but him and his brother did have like the best album cover of all time, though. Satan Is Real.
Oh yeah,
where they're,
I've seen that one.
Where they're posing it in front of like burning tires, and there's like a dopey cutout of Satan behind them.
Yep.
So, Yeah.
I don't know if that's the best album cover of all time, but it's always very prominently mentioned in the worst ones of all time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's funny. It's funny.
We should do that. We should do a show, somehow find like the worst album covers and count them down. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be a list of them.
All kinds of lists of them, but it's a matter of, I mean, people go in all kinds of different directions with what they consider as bad. I don't know. Maybe you and I should compile one.
Yeah, sure. Maybe we should do that.
Or maybe we shouldn't, because that would take a whole buttload of time.
Right, yeah, exactly. But number 19 for you is Johnny Bush with Each Time.
Well, this is what I was talking about earlier. Most of my songs have been guitar-based, but this is the first fiddle-dominant one I've had. And I think one of the reasons, not just country, but a lot of different forms of music have sort of lost their soul a little bit. Country in particular is how they've gotten away from the simple element of playing. I prefer, as I mentioned earlier, guitar-based country, but fiddle-based country is just as soulful, and many people prefer that to guitar-based country, whether it's steel guitar or just regular electric guitar or acoustic. Bush was called the Country Caruso for his voice, which is kind of high-pitched for a country artist. But he made a lot more money off of his songwriting, and he wrote Whiskey River, which was covered very successfully by Willie Nelson. So Johnny Bush cashed in on that one.
Yep, yep.
Next up for you, number 18, None of My Business by Henson Cargill.
This one's sort of similar to Henson Cargill's song Skip a Rope that Todd had a couple weeks ago on here. I mean, it was written by Jack Moran, who also co-wrote that one. This is about ignoring the problems of the world. Poverty, Vietnam, crime, none of my business. Kitty Genovese, the bomb, who cares? Wait, now my preacher wants me to do something about this? Screw that, I don't go to church to hear this crap. Maybe I'll just go somewhere else. Maybe I'll become a Baptist, a snake handler, or God, even a Lutheran. But, I mean, that's the gist of the whole song, but it was advertised as one of the year's most thought-provoking hits. And sure, yeah, I guess it is thought-provoking. But yeah, that's basically what this one is. It's not that bad, though.
It sounds like a man who's got my inner psyche figured out.
Okay.
I mean, there are a lot of things in the world that I can't be bothered to give a shit about, so...
Okay.
I'm not saying everything. I'm just saying there's a lot of things that people get. I think it's amplified by social media these days. You get people freaking out about the littlest shit, and I'll sit there and look at it and be like, who gives a fuck?
Yeah, I'm with you on some of that. Yeah.
Like our podcast, who gives a fuck?
Okay.
I don't care.
Okay.
I co-created it, and I don't care anymore. I'm just kidding.
Okay. But number 17 for you is Hank Snow with The Name of the Game Was Love.
There's no nudie suits going on this album cover. Instead, Snow is decked out in a white winter coat with several horizontal slashes in very primary colors. So very 60s album cover where you got some very contrasty type of album cover. Plus, this is done while Hank Snow is standing in snow because, well, you know, you gotta have some play on words going on here. This is a novelty song where Snow tries to name as many women's names as he possibly can in a song. And judging by the lyrics, Snow is apparently the Wilt Chamberlain of country singers. So it's basically a kind of a country take on the name game, I guess, only with women's names.
Yeah. And I looked at the cover and his jacket, I think that's actually a Hudson Bay jacket.
Whatever it is, it's very 60s, white with like colored slashes across the middle of it, horizontally.
Yeah, it was the Hudson Bay Company gave that to like fur traders. It's kind of like a traditional Canadian coat.
What, so. Fur traders in the 60s? I didn't realize there were any.
Well, these coats date back to like the 1600s.
It looks like it walked straight out of like, that coat looks like it was invented for color television is what it looks like. Like, I mean, really, I mean, a lot of styles in the 60s when color TV came into play, just the simple invention of color TV definitely influenced style in the 60s. And this looks like something.
You're probably right about that. Yeah.
This coat looks like something that was created to capitalize on. Let's get people want to be more colorful. So let's, you know, and it culminated in the 70s where a lot of colors were used badly.
Right. Yeah.
So that was my take on it. It's like, it's a Technicolor dream coat is what it is.
It looks like one.
Maybe it was the Technicolor, like literally the Technicolor dream coat, and Hank Snow stole it from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yes. Yeah, you're right about that.
Anyway, next up for you, a song I referenced earlier. Number 16 is The Girl Most Likely by Jenny C. Riley.
This spiritual sequel to Harper Valley PTA. Not an actual sequel. Jeannie actually did record a sequel to that song in the mid-80s. But anyway, they're both about not judging a book by its cover, while at the same time calling out the hypocrites who do judge the book by the cover. In the song, Jeannie's a girl who's kind of looked down on because she's from a poor family, and she developed earlier than everyone in her class. So everybody assumes that she's going to get knocked up at some point. She's seen as poor white trash. I mean, that's just what happens. But nope, it's Susie Jane, her nemesis, the Miss Goody Two Shoes from her class that gets pregnant. So Jeannie's sitting back and laughing while Susie Jane's dad's chasing the doctor's son around, who did the deed around town with a shotgun. Or as she sings in the song, hearing the shotgun going wham, wham, wham. But she's basically sitting back laughing, saying, "Who's white trash now, Susie?" This is more raucous than Harper Valley PTA. And I've noticed that with the guys on this chart, for the most part, they've been trying to hide the twang in their voice. But the women that I've had on here are pretty upfront with it. And you kind of mentioned this earlier, but GDC Riley is definitely a really good example of that. But there was a clip of this, which looked like it was from Glenn Campbell's show, kind of shot in the similar style to the Glenn and Bobby clip from earlier. But Jeannie's kind of wearing a very short silver mini skirt with like silver go-go boots. And she kind of looks like one of the fembots from Austin Powers. She even has like the like big beehive hairdo too. So kind of the same fake era as that. But the tree swing was not in the background though.
So. No, and it didn't matter because all you do is you look at Jeannie C. Riley because she does look good in that clip. But this song is great. I mean, the choruses of this song are what make it because it gets a little bit more up-tempo and then she does her own call and response, like, "The girl most likely, yeah. I love that stuff. And it's filled with schadenfreude, which I love songs that are filled with schadenfreude.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the entire second half of the song is schadenfreude.
Yeah, that's great. I think this is my favorite song on the whole chart. I love this song. It's great.
It is a really great song. Yeah, I like this one quite a bit. So,
and it has a good beat and you can dance to it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. At 15 for you, we have Luke the Drifter Jr. with Custody.
Luke the Drifter Jr. is Chance the Rapper's grandpa.
Yep.
So I'm told. Not really. Actually, Luke the Drifter was the moniker that Hank Williams Sr. used when he was recording gospel songs. He wanted to record it under a different name because he felt like if it was done under his own name, it would have been marketed a different way, and he didn't want to do that. So it's a long story. But if he was Luke the Drifter, then Luke the Drifter Jr., it would stand to reason that this would actually be the man better known as Bo Cephas, Hank
Williams
Jr. himself. By this point, Hank Williams Jr. had already had 5 top 40 country hits. We think of him as basically an artist who really got cranking in the 70s, and I suppose that's where he became a phenomenon, but he had a lot of hits in the 60s as well when he was younger. And this is very much in the Hank Williams Sr. vein, as most of Hank Williams Jr.'s songs were to this point, until the early 70s when he recoiled against being marketed as a tribute artist and decided to blaze his own path, which was a path that led him down to doing Monday Night Football intros. So,
yeah,
among other things. But it's a good, sad country song about divorce that basically ends with the quote, "You're going with mama, so kiss daddy goodbye," only it's much sadder than that, unquote. If you never knew this was Bo Cephas, there is absolutely nothing that would give you any indication at all that it is. So in a way, it's kind of interesting that it's under the Luke the Drifter Jr. Name, because if you didn't know who the hell Luke the Drifter was, you would never guess this was Hank Williams Jr.
Right. Yeah.
In years. So there you have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I knew Luke the Drifter from Hank Williams, so I assumed that it was Bo Cephas, but
you like knew him literally? Like, was he cool?
No.
Yeah, okay. Next up for you, somebody else who became famous, probably more famous later. Number 14 is "Who's Julie" by Mel Tillis.
This one's a skip. Just needed something to skip here.
How dare you skip Mel Tillis when he was so good in Cannonball Run?
Well, actually, I'm going to reference that later on.
Oh, okay. So. Fair enough.
But number 13 for you is Willie Nelson with "Bring Me Sunshine."
I'm actually skipping a big star, not because it's bad. It is weird to hear Nelson more in Roger Miller mode than outlaw mode, though. That was jarring. I'm skipping it. Some of these other songs were more interesting, to be honest.
Okay. All right.
Next up for you is at number 12 is "The Carroll County Accident" by Porter Wagoner.
It's another story song. It's about a car crash involving two of the most respected residents of Carroll County, Walter Browning and Mary Ellen Jones. Walter was killed. Mary Ellen's on the verge of death. Both of them were married to other people. Why were they in the same car together? Well, Mary Ellen lives long enough to testify that she saw Walter walking along the road. She decided to pick him up and give him a ride. She was just being nice. Nothing scandalous going on. Everyone believes her, but that's not really true. The narrator of the song found a matchbox at the scene of the accident with Walter's wedding ring inside of it, and probably rightfully assumed that Walter put it in there for safekeeping while he was doing the deed. How does the narrator know this? Well, he's his son. And he decides to keep that a secret. He doesn't want to soil his father's reputation. The county's building a memorial to him after all. This one was written by Bob Ferguson. He wrote it while he was on a trip to Nashville. A trip from Nashville to Mississippi. And he was inspired by seeing a Carroll County, Tennessee county limit sign. And he claims that he finished the song shortly after he passed into Carroll County, Mississippi. So it probably took him 4 hours to write this, depending on which route he took. I'm not sure if I-40 or I-55 were still being built when he wrote this. But this won Song of the Year at the CMA Awards. And in every live performance I checked out of this, Porter's wearing a powder blue nudie suit, because what else would Porter Wagoner wear?
Right.
Whenever I see Porter Wagoner, I always think of Henry Gibson's character from Nashville that was based on Porter Wagoner. Porter was much less of a hack than that character, but I could still sort of imagine Porter singing something like "You Must Be Doing Something Right to Last 200 years. Which is like the song that they show Henry Gibson recording in that movie. But this one is pretty good. I like this one. It was pretty enjoyable.
Couple things. First, I've never been to Carroll County, Tennessee, but I have been to Carroll County, Mississippi, because it is along I-55. And the only thing I remember about driving from Memphis to New Orleans is that apart from driving through Jackson, it's pretty much just all kudzu and magnolia trees. It's like really boring.
Pretty much. I mean, that's what I noticed when I was in like the northern half of Mississippi.
It goes
pretty much.
It goes like on that. And on. And Porter Wagoner may have recorded the most unique country song I've ever heard when he did Rubber Room, which was his about yep. his experiences being in a mental institution. That is a great song because it's psychedelic country, basically, is what it is.
Yeah, they kind of like have the flanging effect on his vocals in it when he sings Rubber Room.
That song is an uncategorized. That song can't be categorized. It's cool though. You should seek it out.
Yeah, that is a pretty good one. I like that one. See, but number 11 for you, we have Charlie Pride with Kalijah.
This is a skip. This is also another Hank Sr. cover done live. You know it, the Kalijah, that song.
Yep.
I'm just gonna skip this. Pride died recently of COVID. So we'll just say in tribute to him, rest in peace.
Yep.
Number 10 for you is Who's Gonna Mow Your Grass by Buck Owens.
This one's a departure from Buck's typical sound. For one, there's fuzz guitar in this, which I definitely wasn't expecting. Kind of sounds similar to the fuzzed out pedal steel guitar from the Flying Burrito Brothers' Gilded Palace of Sin album, which coincidentally came out the same month as this chart. And it's also missing the high harmonies from Buck's sidekick Don Rich, which were one of the Buckaroo's trademarks. Buck's doing it all by himself here. It also kind of sounds like a typical like top 40 pop rock record from this time period. I'm not sure if Buck was like actually trying to target that audience with this, but it sort of seems like he was. And the lyrics of this are more or less of like, what are you going to do when I'm gone type of thing? Like, who's going to bring you breakfast in bed? Who's going to keep you warm at night? Who's going to mow your grass? And since this was Buck Owens, there is a clip from Hee Haw for this one. They don't have the fuzz guitar for it quite a bit. And Don Rich is in this performance, but he's singing in unison with Buck, not in harmony. And they kind of switch back and forth between the performance and a film of the Hee Haw gang goofing off on a farm and literally mowing grass with manual push mowers. It's goofy, but this one's pretty good. I was pretty surprised by this one, but really, I mean, you can't go wrong with Buck Owens. Buck Owens is pretty great.
Buck Owens is pretty great. And I cannot believe that something corny was on Hee Haw. That blows my mind.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest shocks ever.
I mean, I can enjoy Hee Haw now, but I enjoy it ironically. Like, there's no way I could ever... I'm not saying I couldn't enjoy it, but it's just so dated in its way. It was dated when it was on live when we were younger. I mean...
Oh, yeah, you're right about that.
But
I'm just, like, total cornball humor. But I mean, that was basically all it was.
Its tropes are funny. People laughing at their own jokes and mugging for the camera. It's like Norman Fell on Three's Company.
Pretty much, yeah. Exactly, yeah. But number 9 for you is John Wesley Riles with K.
Riles was only 18 when this was recorded, so he was kind of the next young up-and-comer in country music, although it never really happened in a big way for him. This song is sung from the point of view of a cab driver who moved to Nashville and brought his girlfriend with him, but she's becoming a star and outgrowing him, and he isn't becoming a star, but he's relaying his experiences to her as a cab driver, basically telling stories about the people he gave rides to. And among the things he sings about are a couple of soldiers coming to Nashville from Fort Campbell, which is just up the road from there. Coming back from Vietnam and saying, quote, hating that war. It is one of the first instances of an anti-war sentiment in a country song. So kind of, and hey, you know, this is, you know, early 1969. That's for the country world, that's pretty early for an anti-war
Oh yeah.
Sentiment, or really any period was probably early for an anti-war sentiment in the country circles, but it is a good story song, and it also brings us to the Wikipedia Fun Fact of the Week, sponsored by the Triple Crown of Trucks. Quote,
okay.
Since the release of his last single in 1988, Riles has served primarily as a background vocalist. He has been the featured voice for television and radio commercials for Walmart, McDonald's, Sears, the American Dairy Association, Dollar General Stores, and Coors Beer. Additionally, he has added background vocals to commercials for American Airlines, Ford Trucks, GMC Trucks, Dodge Trucks, General Electric, and Applebee's. His voice can also be heard in movies, Beverly Hillbillies, Honeymoon in Vegas, Hope Floats, Prince of Egypt, Lawless, Babe, Pig in the City, Scooby-Doo and the Witch's Ghost, and Billy, the Early Years, unquote. He hit the
Billy the Early Years.
He hit the Triple Crown of Trucks. He did voiceovers for all three American brands of trucks. That the country
audience, that's pretty impressive.
It's very impressive, and it's very on brand because people who listen to country are buying American trucks. So,
oh yeah,
the only
yeah.
one he didn't get in there was Chevy trucks, but he hit the GMC, so he got all the three biggies. So
yeah.
He's driving around and with his residuals from that and either his Jimmy or his whatever the other two are. What are the Ford trucks called?
F-150, I think.
That's stupid. Why do they call them that? Why don't you give them a real name?
I don't know.
I'm trying to remember what are Dodges?
Dodges are just Rams.
Oh,
I
yeah,
think.
Dodge Rams. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I should have known that with a Hemi motor in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ford suck. I will never own a Ford ever.
The only time I've really ever driven a Ford was like the van that we have at work. It's not that bad, but it has like a motion sensor in it that just like goes off for anything. Like if a car's like a car length away from you, it just starts beeping, which is really annoying.
Every Ford I've ever driven has been so annoying. I just don't like them. So
yeah, yeah.
But anyway, getting back to this, Riles is doing good these days and is still married to Conway Twitty's daughter, Joni, also. Hmm. Herself a recording artist in the 70s.
Huh.
And now you know the rest of the story.
Did not know that.
Well, now you know the rest of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
As I channel my inner Paul Harvey. Anyway, right. Next up for you, number 8, My Woman's Good to Me by David Houston.
Houston's originally from Bossier City, Louisiana, which is where some of our relatives live.
Indeed.
And he's a descendant of both Sam Houston and Robert E. Lee. So kind of Southern royalty here. He was very hot in the late 60s. He racked up 6 number one hits and 4 other top 5 hits, including this one. There's hardly anything country about this one. It was written by Billy Sherrill and Glenn Sutton, who were kind of the leading forces behind the country paladin sound. And it's more or less a straight up pop ballad with just a tiny little bit of steel guitar popping up every once in a while. It sort of sounds like Gary and the Pacemakers' Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. I kind of surprised that this one didn't cross over in the pop charts because it definitely would not have sounded out of place on the pop charts around this time period, but it's pretty good. And it was actually covered by George Benson later on in 69. And his version is almost as good as this one, but it's obviously a little bit more R&B oriented, more horns in it and stuff like that, but pretty good song.
I think instead of being related to Sam Houston and Robert E. Lee, it would have been much cooler if David Houston was related to Matt Houston and the planet Houston.
Yeah. Well, he could be related to both of those, too.
Maybe he was.
Yeah.
How well is Matt Houston as a show? I don't think I've ever seen a single episode of Matt Houston in my entire life.
I just know the name because it has my name in it. That's pretty much all I know about it.
They should have a battle of early 80s kind of crimey detective / adventure shows. Like they should have Matt Houston versus Hardcastle and McCormick. That would be cool.
Or like the Fall Guy or Simon and Simon.
Simon and Simon versus the Fall Guy. Yeah, you could do that. TJ Hooker versus Hunter, maybe.
Yeah.
Fred Dreyer versus William Shatner. So
throw Magnum PI in there.
Well, Magnum PI was a little cooler than those. I mean, Magnum PI is like in a different, he's like above all that. Him and like Rockford, Jim Rockford, are like above the flotsam that's below that. Like maybe Robert Urich from Vegas might be in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then any number of 70s detective shows that have been forgotten about.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But Matt Houston, I seem to remember him being marketed as like, I don't think he was country, but like, maybe I'm just remembering this totally wrong. Maybe I'm associating the city of Houston with the Matt Houston, but he did seem to have some Southern swab to him because he came after Dallas. So I'm wondering if they were trying to figure out a show. I don't know. I'm not going to go on because I'm going to talk myself into stupidity.
Okay.
I have no idea. Right. I haven't even seen an episode of it, so I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But it always seemed to me it was either like a Southern detective show. And maybe it wasn't at all. Who knows?
Who knows? But number seven for you is George Jones with When the Grass Grows Over.
Oh boy. When Jones changes chords, which is what he's famous for in his songs, that is a beautiful thing. And he does it right off the bat in this song where he goes from low to his low voice to his high voice. The man had some range and was his trademark. Song was written by Don Chappell, Tammy Wynette's first husband, as you were speaking about earlier, of her many. So I imagine this sad breakup song has a little extra special meaning for Don, considering that he wrote it and the man who's recording it is the guy who took Tammy Wynette away from him. So consider this, all three were friends, but Jones had a big crush on Tammy Wynette. He went over for dinner one night, and this was like within a year before this. And Wynette and Chappell allegedly got into an argument where Chappell called Wynette a bitch. Jones got pissed off, flipped over the kitchen table in their gathering, and professed his love to Wynette on the spot. So kind of the damsel in distress type scenario. And all of this was fresh at the time this song was out. I mean, Jones and Wynette got hitched later on in 1969. So this was like in the air. This wasn't like a couple years ago in their lives. This was going on at the time this was out. So imagine George Jones recording this song and being Don Chappell, who's George Jones took Tammy Wynette away from. So Wynette claims she wrote this. So this recording could be interpreted as a giant fuck you to Chappell, I suppose. But this is very country. So this is as country soap opera as it gets.
Definitely. Yeah.
And it's a great song. And When the Grass Grows Over Me, of course, is a reference to, you know, dying, but, you know, staying with, you know, staying sad until the grass grows over me or whatever. And apart from being arrested for driving under their influence while riding a riding lawnmower, it really doesn't get any more country than this. And Jones had a hand in both of those moments. So Jones is country. He is like, if I had an image in my head of country, as much as I like outlaw country, I mean, George Jones is right there in the, you know, he's on the Mount Rushmore country without question. And sadly, the grass grows over everybody involved with this song now. But it is a whopper, and it is George Jones at his best, which is a good thing. So,
right.
But, yeah, yep. Can you imagine? I mean, this was all going on in their lives at the time, and George Jones is like, yeah, I'm going to record his song. I don't give a shit. I'm George Jones. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is kind of weird.
It's country. It's country to the core. Next up for you, a famous one, number six, Daddy Sang Bass by Johnny Cash.
One of Johnny's best known songs. It was written by Carl Perkins, who we had on the chart earlier. At the time, he was serving as a replacement for Johnny's original lead guitarist, Luther Perkins, no relation, in Cash's backing band, the Tennessee Three. And obviously he was a member of Sun Records' Million Dollar Quartet with Cash and Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis back in the 50s. This one's about a family that gets together every night to sing and forget about their problems, and the hope that they'll all reunite someday in heaven to do the same thing. Johnny plays himself as the narrator and his dad in the chorus. Jan Howard sings the mama part in the studio version. Most people assume that that was June Carter Cash, but it wasn't. She did sing it live and in pretty much every TV performance I saw of this song, though. And Don Reed and Lou DeWitt from the Statler Brothers play the younger version of Johnny and his little brother. The Statlers were also part of Johnny's touring ensemble at the time. And a large chunk of the song is based around the hymn, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, which kind of deals with the same themes as the rest of the song. And since I mentioned June Carter Cash, her family played a big role in popularizing that hymn. They did the original family sing-along to that one. But great song, and this was nominated for Song of the Year, but it lost to Carroll County Accident. So
it's a good song. And Will the Circle Remain Unbroken? That's kind of like the Rosetta Stone of country songs, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, the hymn itself was written like at the turn of the century, and then A.P. Carter kind of like redid it in like the late 20s, early 30s. So it was like legitimately like one of the very first actual country songs.
Well, you didn't let me finish my sentence. It's either that or Achy Breaky Heart by Billy Ray Cyrus.
This is funny, but I'm going to actually reference that to one of our, there's a reference to that song coming
up. Oh,
goody.
Here. The same year that I lived above the truck driving neighbors / Hurt So Good video, they got, that was the year that Achy Breaky Heart came out. And I'm assuming they got the 45 for it because they kept playing, they played it like literally for an entire weekend.
Oh,
and
guys,
I could hear it through my ceiling, and it was just, it was torture.
I bet it
was. I can handle anything else the world can throw at me after that weekend of Achy Breaky Heart. It was fucking horrible.
Yeah. Number five for you, we have Conway Twitty with Darling, You Know I Wouldn't Lie.
We've gone from George Jones to Johnny Cash to Conway Twitty. We are in country music heaven, people.
Yep.
Here, Conway is talking to his wife or his girlfriend after he was caught cheating, but supposedly cut off the relationship, his cheating relationship. The last verse is awesome. It says, quote, "She wanted to hold me forever, and this lipstick shows her final try. And these tears on my shoulder are proof that she failed. And darling, you know I wouldn't lie." Now, I didn't do it justice, but put that in Conway Twitty's voice, and it's much better. So did Conway cheat again, or did he really break it off? It doesn't matter, because Conway Twitty is singing it, and that's good enough for me. It does remind me a little bit of the Conway Twitty, Loretta Lynn magnum opus, As Soon As I Hang Up the Phone, which might very well be my favorite country song of all time. It's in that same, you know, breakup-ish argument with your girlfriend mode that that song is in. So I think Conway just cheated again and is lying, but, you know.
Probably.
So, but he's Conway Twitty. He can do shit like that. That's what he does.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but Conway Twitty, I've professed my enjoyment of Conway Twitty before, so I'm going to profess my enjoyment again. He's really fun to listen to.
Yeah, yeah, he is.
Next up for you, number four, Good Time Charlie's by Del Reeves.
Del is short for Delano. His full name is Franklin Delano Reeves, and he was born shortly after FDR won the nomination in 1932. He's primarily known for doing novelty songs, and this one kind of sort of straddles a line between novelty and legitimate country. It's done in the style of Buck Owens and the Buckaroos. He's kind of going towards the style that Buck was walking away from with Who's Gonna Mow Your Grass. This one's about a wild honky-tonk called Good Time Charlie's, and it's kind of the same deal as Joan Mabel's from earlier in the chart, or Buck Owens' Sam Place, but this place is a lot more violent than either of those places. Del sings about how Charlie more or less murdered a guy who caused trouble there. But if you don't cause trouble, you probably won't get murdered there. They have wall-to-wall women and ice-cold beer. It's fun. But Reeves also dabbled in acting and appeared in the movie Sam Whiskey later in 1969, which was one of Burt Reynolds' first starring roles in a movie. And it started the tradition of Burt appearing in movies with country stars. So it kicked in the door for Jerry Reed and Mel Tillis to later on appear in Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run. But Reeves is also responsible for signing Billy Ray Cyrus to his first record contract.
Die in a Fire.
Yeah, so we have him to thank for Achy Breaky Heart and Old Town Road. And for the record, this one has absolutely nothing to do with Danny O'Keefe's Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues. And this is a much better song than that. Yeah, but
that wouldn't.
This one's pretty good, though.
It never even occurred to me that Del would be short for Delano. And now that I think about it, I can't think of anybody. I don't think I've ever known a Del in my life ever. But it seemed like there was a lot of baseball players and football players in the 60s that were named Del.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In the 50s, so that makes sense because I guess that would have been the time period that. That name would have been, you know, because of FDR would have been prominent. I guess that's why, maybe. It's also short for Delvin.
I think Del Crandall was Delbert.
And Delbert, yeah. So,
yeah.
The last Del I can remember was, and I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody, was Delvin Williams, who was a running back for the Dolphins, when I first started following football. I can't think of any Dells, so there's probably has been, but.
Well, the one that popped into my mind for being recent or relatively recent was Del James, the guy who came up with like the Don't Cry and November Rain videos.
Well, yeah, that was the first thing that jumped into my mind too.
Yeah.
But that's not a name you, just like my name, that's not a name you, oh, well, how could I forget Del the Funky Homo Sapien?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think his real name is Del,
well, no,
though.
But, you know, but it is out there, so.
Right, yeah, exactly. But number three for you is Sonny James with Only the Lonely.
This song was a little bit of a come down after some of the other highlights that we've had on this chart. It is a Roy Orbison cover. But it's kind of done in champagne country style. So real slow, slow piano, that kind of thing. However, Sonny James was on quite a roll at this point. This is one of his 16 straight number one singles from country singles from 1967 to 71. He had 26 number ones overall. And however, he had all of them obviously before either one of our times. And I don't, you know, hardcore country people, I'm sure, know exactly who Sonny James is, but if you told me that Sonny James had 26 number ones overall, I would have said you're high, because I barely know who Sonny James is. So
yeah, same with
so me. Somebody who's kind of been lost to, you know, differing trends and all of that. So I didn't really care for this song, but. But obviously country artists at this time or country fans at this time did. So.
Right. Yeah.
By the way, we forgot Del Harris.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Bucks coach.
I'm looking at a list of Dells and almost all of them are from Del Rogers, who played for the Packers in the early 80s. Forgot about him. Kick return.
Okay.
Del Schaffner. Yeah. He was 60.
Oh, Del Schaffner,
60s
yeah.
Football player. Del Webb. Del Shannon, of course, 60s
yeah.
Singer. So,
yeah.
But the most famous one, according to this list, is Del the Funky Homo Sapien. So there you go.
Okay.
I think they might have a little recency bias there. I think Del Shannon might be just a tad.
Yeah, I'd, I'd rate Del Shannon as more famous than Del DeFunky Homo Sapien, but
they should get into a diss rap battle, the two of them, if Del Shannon were still with us.
Yeah.
Anyway, next up for you, number two is Until My Dreams Come True by Jack Green.
This one's kind of underwhelming. I mean, it's probably my least favorite song out of the ones that I had this week. Sometimes that happens, the worst one being at number two. It's a pretty standard country ballad, nothing really special about it. It was written by Dallas Frazier, who's best known for writing and singing the original version of Elvira, which became a huge hit for the Oak Ridge Boys. This sounds nothing like Elvira, obviously, and unfortunately. But the one clip that I could find of him performing this from this era, he's wearing a lime green nudie suit, because if your name's Green, what else are you going to wear?
Right.
And he looks an awful lot like the guy who played Ben Linus on Lost, Michael Emerson. Okay. And if J.J. Abrams had been thinking, maybe he could have tied Jack Green into the whole convoluted mythology of the island. Or maybe it's better that he didn't. But we'll never know. So
it begs the question, what color nudie suit would you get?
I don't know. Maybe blue, like a royal blue.
I kind of feel and felt green on this one. Like maybe like Jack Green's nudie suit. I went to the tourist trappy, the record store or whatever it's called on Broadway in Nashville. And they sell nudie suits. And I remember looking at them and I wasn't going to get one, but I mean, I was like, which one would I get if I were to get one? So they don't come in that many colors, really, if you think about it. So,
yeah, I imagine they wouldn't. Most of the ones that these guys were wearing were probably like custom.
I mean, is a white nudie suit considered to be like traditional? Is that like your Sunday best nudie suit? Like, do you wear that to church?
I don't know. Possibly.
I mean, Johnny Cash didn't wear nudie suits, so I've never seen a black nudie suit that I know of. Maybe I have and forgot about it, but well, yeah, I have. I've seen them. Never mind. But
actually, well, one of the Flying Burrito Brothers had a black nudie suit.
Well, and I want to say,
I think Sneaky Pete did.
I want to say maybe. I mean, Clint Black didn't wear nudie suits either, but maybe he donned one for like a tribute or something. I don't know. I know I've seen one, but. I don't know. Maybe a yellow nudie suit would be nice.
That'd be cool. I mean, what shade of yellow? Like mustard?
No.
Yellow?
No, I'm thinking like bright yellow. Like stop.
Oh, okay.
Stoplight yellow.
Like fluorescent?
Yeah. Or... Well, I mean, that's kind of the nudie suit thing. I mean, you're basically dealing in day glow colors, really. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
You could go with an orange. I'm sure I've seen an orange nudie suit, but you could roll with that, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe like creamsicle colored orange.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
Like the old Tampa Bay Buccaneers uniforms.
Yeah, that would be good. But I don't know, like you have to get away from primary colors. Like you couldn't pull off like a regular red nudie suit. I don't think that would look right.
Yeah, you're right about that.
So I don't even know if red.
It would have to be like salmon or something.
Yeah, and
like
you're getting
that.
A little too close to pink. I mean, pink nudie suit would work, but you know, red is the one primary color where I don't think you can nudie suit it. I don't think you can do it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
So,
yeah.
I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to buy one because
okay,
I was born
okay.
to wear a nudie suit. You know it.
We're at number one here.
We are. Go for it.
Jerry Lee Lewis with To Make Love Sweeter for You.
Well, with this song, we're pretty far away from Great Balls of Fire, his rockabilly masterpiece. This song is piano-based, of course, because Jerry Lee played piano, but it also has prominent steel guitar and kind of a whimsical fiddle in the middle of it to kind of change the mood of the song a bit. This was a big comeback, at least on the country, well, in general, but also certainly on the country side of things for Jerry Lee, whose last number one on the country chart was Great Balls of Fire in 1958. Lewis did dabble in country. I mean, he wasn't known for that really up until this point, although he did cut country songs from time to time. And he did another one in 1968 called Another Place, Another Time, more or less on a whim, and it ended up being a surprise hit. At the time, Lewis was playing Iago in a rock and roll adaptation of Othello at that point. Yes, that actually, Jerry Lee Lewis was in Othello.
Okay.
And because of that, Another Place, Another Time, he decided to cut a country record, and it became really big in the country world. And he kind of went in for a little bit of it wasn't an image change so much as kind of embracing the almost downcast side of country. The album cover for this song from the album She Still Comes Around maybe reflects Lewis's mood a little bit. It's taken in a seedy motel room where Lewis is sitting sort of forlorn on a bed as reflected through a hotel mirror. So you're not looking directly at him. You're looking at him through a mirror. Kind of a seedy image, but kind of going for that, you know, real, quote unquote, real country type stuff. Lewis's country comeback produced 17 top 10 singles through 1977. So he really had a second life in country on the charts. Probably the best known of those songs is What's Made Milwaukee Famous, which is a beer slash breakup song, I guess, or post-breakup song, which has been covered by quite a few artists, including Rod Stewart. And it's definitely the best song written about Schlitz by wide margin. Lewis is still with us. He's 85 now, probably one of the last 1950s rock stars to still be walking the earth. And really, for that matter, one of the last 1960s country stars to also be still with us. He's, to say the least, lived a checkered life. But but Jerry Lee is certainly a legend, both in rock and in country music. So there you have it.
Yep, yep.
And you know what you're getting with Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, this, it does sound like the logical progression from like rockabilly to where he would be 10 years later if he stayed, you know, kept his fingers in the country world. It seems like it's a normal progression.
Yeah, yeah, you're right about that.
And he certainly inspired people like Mickey Gilley would not exist without Jerry Lee Lewis, basically. I don't think that would even have ever even happened. It's basically the same kind of sound. So
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That wraps it up for this week. What is on tap for next week?
Let's see. We're going to the Hot 100 for March 3rd, 1984.
Ooh.
We did a 1984 Hot 100, but it was later in the year. So this entirely different batch of songs. And this is honestly one of the best charts that I've ever come across.
Well, you can't go wrong with 1984. Chart.
Yeah, I mean, it is going to be hard to come up with skips on this one because this one is pretty much like wall-to-wall classics from that era. So
yeah, and you also screwed me the week after that because I was going to go to 1984 on the mainstream rock chart, but that's out the window. Thanks, okay. Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Well, that will be hitting some high highlights. Should we?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So I'll look forward to that. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yep. And we'll see you all in 1984.
I'm going to wear my Terminator glasses.
Yes. Yeah.
And
I'll break those out, too.
I'm only going to eat things that were officially sponsored by the LA Olympics.
So just like McDonald's and Coke?
Among many other things. I mean, Kraft food, basically, I think.
Oh, okay, okay. I didn't realize that they were also a sponsor.
I pretty much think half of the corporate food that was available was sponsored the LA Olympics. So,
right.
Sustain
well,
yourself
I mean,
for life on it.
Probably the Sarajevo Olympics were going on.
Yeah, but I'm not going for historical accuracy. I'm going for 1984 vibe.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Yep. See ya.
Are you coming in or are you going to piss about all day?
You're bloody finished. You know that, Jack. I bloody finished you.